This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is the New York Times Magazine for Sunday, May 19th. I'm Dave Abbott. Last week I started the article, "Donald Trump Has Never Sounded Like This," by Charles Homans. This week I will conclude. And to remind, last week I ended with the discussion with Kiki Hunt, a bail bonds and hairstyling expert from South Carolina, who had gone to Washington when they breached the Capitol. Continuing now, inside the arena, a low rumble of synthesizer playing a vaguely liturgical suspended chord filled the space. A mass of men's voices came in singing the Star-Spangled Banner. The recording was poor quality, far away sounding, and distorted around the edges, and the voices had a hauntingly flat and gray affect as they sang of the twilight's last gleaming. Then the voice of the former president clear rose above them. "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America." The crowd listened respectfully. It was a recording called Justice for All, released early last year, credited to Donald Trump and the J6 Prison Choir, a group of men among those currently serving prison sentences related to the January 6th riot, a majority for having assaulted police officers, who were recorded singing over the phone from the D.C. jail. As the prisoners reached the end of the anthem, they broke into a chant, "USA, USA, USA." The crowd joined in, unified in the new resistance. The recording's producers included Kash Patel, a former Trump administration intelligence staff member who was involved in Trump's 2024 campaign. It opened Trump's first proper rally of this campaign in March 2023 in Waco, Texas, and in the rallies since. It offered a compressed version of one of the campaign's central arguments, that Trump's prosecutions were an extension of the dispossession of the Trump faithful in 2020, and that the weight of the state would fall not only on Trump, but on anyone patriotic enough to dare to stand with him. Joe Biden and the fascists that control him are really the true threat to democracy, Trump told us that afternoon. They use the DOJ, the FBI, our election systems. They rigged our elections and attacked free speech. It is amazing all the people that go get investigated, all of them. They don't go after the people that rigged the election. They go after the people that want to find out who it was that rigged it. As the speech neared its conclusion, the room once again filled with music, a stately cinematic swell of synthesized strings. This recording, an instrumental composition called Mirrors, was also thick with subtextual information. Several years ago, it was appropriated, seemingly at random, by devotees of QAnon, the conspiracist cosmology that holds Trump to be the central figure in a world historical battle against a cabal of Democrats, business leaders, and celebrities trafficking and torturing children. In 2022, Trump appropriated it, too, using the song for a video he released on social media, and later at a rally in Ohio as a soundtrack for the rousing finale of his speech. Although a spokesman denied that it was a wink at the QAnon faithful, supporters at the rally responded by raising their hands in the familiar QAnon gesture. As was so often the case with Trump, what had at first been scandalous had quickly become standard. Mirrors now closed out every Trump rally, a bookend to Justice for All. As the song played in Rock Hill, he told the crowd, "Together we are taking on some of the most menacing forces and vicious opponents our people have ever seen, but no matter how hateful and corrupt the communists and criminals we are fighting are, You must never forget this nation does not belong to them. This nation belongs to you. This is your home. This is your heritage. And our American liberty is your God-given right. The crowd was on its feet as he recited his benediction. Together we will make America powerful again. We will make America wealthy again. We will make America strong again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. The people, his people, roared. Trump did a little dance. Then he descended the stage in the direction of the barricade. A wave of excitement rippled through the crowd. The four-on-the-floor backbeat of YMCA thumped through our close-packed bodies like a shared pulse. He was brandishing his permanent marker like a conductor's baton, briskly autographing campaign signs and MAGA merchandise. Sweat was beading around the edges of his makeup. "Don't reach out to him," a rally veteran advised us. "Just yell at him." As Trump passed, my view was momentarily obstructed by a woman's wide-brimmed hat, glittering with sequins, stars, and stripes, and covered in buttons. The largest featured a grinning Trump framed by the words, "One last time God sends America a leader." Another read, "Trust is an expression of love." Early in his Rock Hill speech, Trump had paused to recognize one of the Republican politicians in attendance, Representative Joe Wilson of South Carolina. Wilson's profile in national politics consisted mostly of a single moment. During President Barack Obama's address to Congress in September of 2009, when Wilson interrupted Obama by shouting, "You lie." Somewhat less remembered than Wilson's outburst is its context. He was objecting to Obama's assertion that the Affordable Care Act would not cover undocumented immigrants, a preoccupation of the ascendant Tea Party movement. As a candidate, 6 years later, Trump adopted and further radicalized the Tea Party's immigration politics, which cast migrants as the tip of the spear of a globalist effort to undermine the security and identity of the United States. Wilson's outburst was one of those moments in pre-Trump politics that seems exotically distant now. The genuine shock with which it was met in the political class, genuine enough that Wilson, at the urging of congressional leadership, called the White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel, to apologize. An anachronism of a bygone age. The interruption now seems not just normal, but seminal. A blueprint for the MAGA generation that came after Wilson. He said, "You lie, remember?" Trump told the crowd in Rock Hill. "I'm sure nobody remembers that, but I do. He is one of the most incredible people." Seated not far from Wilson at the rally was Marjorie Taylor Greene, the second-term Georgia congresswoman and Trump sidekick. Since the beginning of Biden's presidency, Greene has become a serial interrupter of his speeches, refining and expanding on Wilson's legacy. She arrived at the Capitol for Biden's March 7th State of the Union address in a Make America Great Again hat and a matching red blazer festooned with buttons. One of them featured a photo of a smiling young woman, a 22-year-old nursing student named Lakin Riley, who had been murdered the month before while she was jogging on the campus of the University of Georgia. The day after Riley disappeared, around the time Trump took the stage in Rock Hill, the campus police arrested a suspect in the case, an undocumented 26-year-old Venezuelan migrant named Jose Antonio Ibarra. It soon emerged that Ibarra had previously been arrested after crossing the border near El Paso in September 2022, requested asylum, and was later released while his case awaited adjudication. Since then, he'd been arrested on suspicion of shoplifting and released again. As Biden glad-handed his way down the aisle on his way to the dais, Greene attracted his attention and managed to hand him a button that said, "Say her name, Lakin Riley." It was a phrase slyly borrowed from the emotional appeals of the racial justice movement. "Say her name," Greene shouted repeatedly at Biden during the speech until he finally veered off script. "Lincoln Riley, Biden said, garbling her first name, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. He held up the button Green had given him. This was, by any measure, the greatest coup of the many that Green had pulled off in her short time in office, and it happened just 2 days before Trump was scheduled to hold a rally in Green's hometown, Rome, Georgia. In Rome that afternoon, I saw two women standing outside the arena, one of them holding up a large placard with Riley's picture on it and saying that said, "Say her name." They were being interviewed by Vanessa Brassard, an anchor for Right Side Broadcasting Network, an online streaming outlet that serves as a kind of house organ of Trump's government in exile. Green is dating one of the network's anchors. "Lakin Riley, tragic story," Broussard was saying. "Let's talk about that and how, you know, this hit home, not just because this was a beautiful American college student, but also right here in your backyard, here in Georgia. It is very concerning with us who have kids and grandkids, you know, and families and friends that's got younger kids," said the woman with the sign, a 56-year-old rental property manager from Ellijay, Georgia, named Deanna Foley. "It's tragic. It's embarrassing that Joe Biden's not even acknowledging her." "Absolutely," Broussard said. "It's disgusting." When Broussard moved on, I asked the women how they had heard about Riley's murder. "Fox News," Foley replied. "That's the only news I watch." "Illegal immigration," she told me, "was the most important issue for her in the election. I'm very concerned, you know, with the human trafficking, child trafficking, and the crime that goes along with it, fueled by illegal aliens and the cartels," she said. "And then there were the tens of thousands of children who had gone missing in Ukraine since the Russian invasion," she added. "That's just nothing but a human trafficking thing right there. Many children, perhaps thousands, were indeed abducted from Ukraine by Russian soldiers in the early days of the war. Journalistic and legal investigations have found that many are being held in Russia, where they have been subjected to re-education and used occasionally for propaganda purposes. But this did not seem to be what Foley was talking about. What do you think is happening to all those kids?" I asked. "Pedophiles," Foley replied. "The Illuminati." "Definitely pedos," her friend Tina Murray interjected. "Pedophiles," Foley said again. "Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, Hollywood," Murray said. This sounded like the QAnon theory of the world, in which practically any event could be explained and connected by a great liberal child trafficking conspiracy. When I mentioned QAnon, Foley nodded. "I like Q," she said. "They give people hope in very sad and low times." "You've got to use your discernment online," Foley went on, "but you don't use your discernment on the Democrats, because, I mean, they're just..." She paused, looking for the word. "Against America." "So you think all the stuff about them is true that you see out there?" I asked. "On the Democrats? Yeah." "Oh, absolutely. It's worse than I could even ever dream of." "The threat of violent migrant criminals has been a foundational element of Trump's politics and his rallies since 2015, and by early this year it had assumed center stage in Trump's speeches as he began to back away, not entirely, but noticeably, from last year's talk of vermin and internal enemies. This reflected an actual worsening of the situation along the southern border, which remains one of Biden's great political vulnerabilities, enough so that Trump leaned on Republican lawmakers to kill a bipartisan immigration bill in the Senate in January, reportedly because he hoped to continue campaigning on the issue. But it also seemed possible that Trump was aware he had perhaps pushed things a little far in the revenge department. Talking to voters in Iowa, away from the bubbles of the presidential campaigns over the course of several weeks leading up to the January caucuses there, I had been surprised to hear a number of longtime Republicans and Trump supporters expressing wariness about Trump, and for the first time I could remember, openly worrying about what he might do if he won. "I voted for Trump twice, Bob Meyer, 75, a retired bar and gas station owner in the town of Lake City, told me. I still like the man. I like what he says, but I wouldn't vote for him again because that's how dictators take over. Enough similar misgivings seemed to have reached Trump that he revised himself in a Fox News town hall in Des Moines in January. We're going to make this country so successful again, he said. I'm not going to have time for retribution. At the same time, Trump's denunciations of migrants poisoning the blood of America, a phrase that immediately drew Hitler comparisons, which drew Trump's loud insistence at a rally in Waterloo, Iowa, that I never read Mein Kampf, was a reminder that his immigration rhetoric was the same song in a different key. If immigration was Trump's clearest link to the Tea Party, it was also his clearest link to an emerging class of European leaders in countries like Poland and Hungary, who, at the time of his election, were infusing Perón-style post-war populism with right-wing xenophobia and nativism, a far darker parallel legacy of interwar fascism. On March 8th, the night before the Rome rally, Trump met with Prime Minister Viktor Orbán of Hungary, the most successful European practitioner of this strain of authoritarianism. Over the past several years, Orbán has become a darling of American right-wing intellectuals for his unapologetic defense of an illiberal state and his hardline immigration policy, framing each as part of the remaking of his country as a stronghold of traditional European culture and identity. In his recent speeches, Trump, too, was grasping for a larger context for his denunciations of migrants, though with none of Orbán's deftness, instead unspooling increasingly extravagant and explosive conspiracy theories. The border crisis was a deliberate act on the part of the Biden administration, he told his crowds. The second part of a process of disenfranchising Americans and attaining permanent democratic rule that began with the theft of the 2020 election. Biden's conduct on our border is by any definition a conspiracy to overthrow the United States of America, he said in Greensboro, North Carolina, a week before the Rome rally. He is a danger to democracy. Number one, he goes after his political opponent, which nobody's ever done in this country. But beyond that, he warned, Biden and his accomplices want to collapse the American system, nullify the will of the actual American voters, and establish a new base of power that gives them control for generations. Now in Rome, he gazed out at the arena as the crowd held up Lake and Riley placards like the one Foley held outside. You understand what's happening here, he told us. Joe Biden has no remorse. He's got no regret. He's got no empathy, no compassion. Worst of all, he has no intention of stopping the deadly invasion that stole precious Lakin's beautiful American life. What Joe Biden has done on our border is a crime against humanity and the people of this nation for which he will never be forgiven, he went on. I will stop this invasion. I'm going to do it. I will stop the killing. I will stop the bloodshed. I will end the agony of our people, the plunder of our cities, the sacking of our towns, the violation of our citizens, and the conquest of our country. They're conquering our country. These people are conquering our country. When mirrors came on toward the end and Trump spoke of our final battle, a young man in the stands behind me bellowed the QAnon rallying cry at the top of his lungs, where we go one, we go all. Who are these people that would do this to us, Trump asked. Who are these people who would destroy our country? Democrats, the people around me shouted. A woman behind me held her hands, prayer-like, against her lips. He seemed reinvigorated that night, speaking for a half hour longer than usual. He was improvising and digressing again, riffing with the crowd, moving beyond the stock bits that he shuffled around most nights. The crowd, too, seemed electrified in a way I'd not seen for years. The lifting up of the martyr, the processing of her death into rage, the processing through Trump of the rage into joy, the old alchemy was working again. On the arena floor, the last stragglers were dancing merrily to a final round of YMCA and grinning for selfies. Scattered on the floor around their feet were discarded Say Her Name placards. Riley's face, limp and sticky with spilled soda. The tiny print near the bottom of her picture was scuffed, but I could still make it out. Paid for by Donald J. Trump for President 2024, Inc. Next, What I've Learned from My Students' College Essays by Nell Freudenberger. She's a novelist who volunteers through the PEN, America Writers in the Schools program. Most high school seniors approach the college essay with dread. Either their upbringing hasn't supplied them with several hundred words of adversity, or worse, they're afraid that packaging the genuine trauma they have experienced is the only way to secure their future. The college counselor at the Brooklyn High School, where I am a writing tutor, advises against trauma porn. Keep it brief, she says, and show how you rose above it. I started volunteering in New York City schools in my 20s before I had kids of my own. At the time, I liked hanging out with teenagers whom I sometimes had more interesting conversations with than I did my peers. Often I worked with students who spoke English as a second language or who used slang in their writing, and at first I was hung up on grammar. Should I correct any deviation from standard English to appeal to some Wizard of Oz behind the curtains of a college admissions office? Or should I encourage students to write the way they speak in pursuit of an authentic voice, that most elusive of literary qualities? In fact, I was missing the point. One of the many lessons the students have taught me is to let the story dictate the voice of the essay. A few years ago, I worked with a boy who claimed to have nothing to write about. His life had been ordinary, he said. Nothing had happened to him. I asked if he wanted to try writing about a family member, his favorite school subject, a summer job. He glanced at his phone, his posture and expression suggesting that he would rather be anywhere but in front of a computer with me. Hobbies? I suggested, without much hope. He gave me a shy glance. I like to box, he said. I have had this experience with reluctant writers again and again. When a topic clicks with a student, an essay can unfurl spontaneously. Of course, the primary goal of a college essay is to help its author get an education that leads to a career. Changes in testing policies and financial aid have made applying to college more confusing than ever, but essays have remained basically the same. I would argue that they are much more than an onerous task or rote exercise, and that unlike standardized tests, they are infinitely variable and sometimes beautiful. College essays also provide an opportunity to learn precision, clarity, and the process of working toward the truth through multiple revisions. Even if writing doesn't end up being fundamental to their future professions, students learn to choose language carefully and to be suspicious of the first words that come to mind, especially now, as college students shoulder so much of the country's ethical responsibility for war with their protest movement. Essay writing teaches prospective students an increasingly urgent lesson that choosing their own words over ready-made phrases is the only reliable way to ensure they are thinking for themselves. Teenagers are ideal writers for several reasons. They are usually free of preconceptions about writing, and they tend not to use self-consciously literary language. They are allergic to hypocrisy and are generally unfiltered. They overshare, ask personal questions, and call you out for microaggressions as well as less egregious but still mortifying verbal errors, such as referring to weed as pot. Most important, they have yet to put down their best stories in a finished form. I can imagine an essay taking a risk and distinguishing itself formally, a poem or a one-act play, but most kids use a more straightforward model, a hook followed by a narrative built around small moments that lead to a concluding lesson or aspiration for the future. I never get tired of working with students on these essays because each one is different, and the short, rigid form sometimes makes an emotional story even more powerful. Before I read Javier Zamora's wrenching Solito, I worked with a student who had been transported by a coyote into the U.S. and was reunited with his mother in the parking lot of a big box store. I don't remember whether this essay focused on specific skills or coping mechanisms that he gained from his ordeal. I remember only the bliss of the parent and child reunion in that uninspiring setting. If I were making a case to an admissions officer, I would suggest that simply being able to convey that experience demonstrates the kind of resilience that any college should admire. The essays that have stayed with me over the years don't follow a pattern. There are some narratives on very predictable topics, living up to the expectations of immigrant parents or suffering from depression in 2020, that are moving because of the attention with which the student describes the experience. One girl determined to become an engineer while watching her father build furniture from scraps after work. A boy grieving for his mother during lockdown, beginning to take pictures of the sky. If, as Laurie Moore said, a short story is a love affair, a novel is a marriage, what is a college essay? Every once in a while, I sit down next to a student and start reading. And I have to suppress my excitement because there on the Google Doc in front of me is a real writer's voice. One of the first students I ever worked with wrote about falling in love with another girl in dance class. The absolute magic of watching her move and the terror in the conflict between her feelings and the instruction of her religious middle school. She made me think that college essays are less like love than limerence. One-sided, obsessive, idiosyncratic, but profound. The first draft of the most personal story their writers will ever tell. That's all my time for today. This is Dave Abbott. This has been the New York Times Magazine. Thanks so much for listening, and let's be careful out there.